This is Audible.
Oasis Audio presents Addicted to Busy by Brady Boyd. Read for you by Wes Bleed. Introduction. This book won't change your life. I'm a complete hypocrite for writing this book because I don't actually live out the restful rhythms I so passionately espouse. However, I do recognize that digging in my heels and demanding self-discipline will never correct my errant ways. These behaviors can't and won't correct your errant ways either, which is why I can so boldly declare that this book will not change your life. Books don't change our lives. Here's what will change our rhythms, our pace, our lives. Revelation from the Spirit of God, or, in other words, the ability to detect spiritually what we've had only sensory knowledge of before. Yes, life is made up of tasks on the to-do list, kids rattling off their incessant needs and wants, the hurried embrace of a spouse who is rushing off to carpool, the scent of one more bag of fast food. Really, now, who has time to cook anymore? But life also involves an undercurrent, a spiritual underpinning holding together our days. It's the God story that contextualizes the us story. It's a spiritual understanding that makes our lives make sense. The highest goal I can set for this book is that it will somehow serve as a conduit for the revelation we so sorely need. Mere words on a page can't talk us out of our beloved freneticism, but the Holy Spirit can and will if we let Him. I want this revelation, and yet I don't. Because on the heels of real revelation, real deal growth is required. Revelation is not for the faint at heart, wrote Anne Lamott. But how beautiful it is when it finally appears. Without it, Anne said, life can seem like an endless desert of danger with scratchy sand in your shoes. And yet if we remember or are reminded to pay attention, we find so many sources of hidden water, so many bits and chips and washes of color in a weed or the gravel or a sunrise. There are so many ways to sweep the sand off our feet. So we say, oh my God, thanks. That sense of gratitude is what I desperately want to feel. I want to receive revelation. I want to live from revelation, and I want to thank God for gently prodding me to slow my pace, saving my sanity. And yet here are a couple of questions I mull over. Would I even know how to live a slowed-down life? Would I know what to do with rest? When I was first handed my newborn son, even though I was instantly in love with him, there was this question rushing through my brain. What does it do? Would I look at a well-rested life the same way? How do I hold it? What is it good for? What on earth does it do? I wonder if he'd be the guy who would unravel the quiet of it all. Still, I'm willing to try. I'm willing to put on a rhythmic life. As Maya Angelou said in her unfailingly poetic way, when you know better, you do better. I've known better for a long, long time. I'm ready for the doing better part to begin. In Jewish tradition, the command to keep the Sabbath holy is followed religiously, beginning at sundown Friday and lasting a full 24 hours until sundown Saturday. Friday evening, as a way to welcome the prescribed unplug, the family recites a blessing, Kiddush it's called, literally meaning holy. There's a Kiddush cup that you use, which looks like an ornate goblet that's been glued to a small saucer, a saucer that's really important, not only in function, but also in form. When the blessing is recited, typically the father of the family pours wine into the goblet until it overflows, spilling out. You can get the cup and saucer for $15 on Amazon, but you can get what it represents only by living a rhythmic life. The pouring out, the overflow, the blessing. The symbol here, as the Sabbath begins, is that God's abundance cannot be contained. This is what I'm after, feeling not empty, but full, living not at full throttle, but at rest. Letting whatever abundance God has in store for me come in, sit down, and be at home. Part 1. Disease. Burnout as a status symbol. We are so busy, usually too busy for God. Leonard Sweet. Chapter 1. Dead Husband Walking. There is more to life than increasing its speed. Mahatma Gandhi. Fighting Healthy Rhythms. I began fighting what I call rhythmic living, living intentionally, sanely, and at peace, at an early age. The childhood version of me was a boy who was always moving, always doing, and always lacking appreciation for rest. There was a horse to ride through the woods, and there were deer to hunt and fish to catch. What use was slowing down and reflecting on things when all this life was waiting to be lived? As I morphed into a teenager, my pace only intensified. I was born with a heart condition and found I had to work twice as hard as my buddies in order to achieve the same sports-related goals. So I pushed, 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 insisting my body run faster, go farther, and play harder. Intellectually, I was exactly the same way. I pushed just as hard in both high school and college, always hungering and thirsting for more information, more knowledge, more understanding of this thing called life. I wasn't naturally smart, but I was naturally curious. Curiosity dictated my pace in life, and curiosity never sits down. My wife, Pam, and I married when we were 22, and within 5 years I was running my life at unprecedented speeds, even for me. We lived in Shreveport, Louisiana at the time, where I taught junior and senior level English literature at Evangel Christian Academy, a prep school with several hundred children. That role alone would have meant a full plate for me, but I treated it as a mere side dish, adding to it half a dozen other appetizing things. I was the boys' varsity basketball coach. I was the girls' varsity basketball coach. I was the boys' JV basketball coach and also the junior high boys' basketball coach. I was the high school track and field coach, one of the campus pastors for the school, and the volunteer youth pastor at the church associated with the school. These combined commitments meant I was gone from 6 or 7 in the morning until 10 or 11 at night, teaching, conducting parent-teacher conferences, grading papers, tutoring students, leading practices, driving buses, coaching games, washing uniforms in the locker room's laundry facility, and more. During that season of life, the greatest compliment you could have paid me was, "Wow, you're always so busy." To me, busyness equaled movement, and movement was necessary for me to get ahead. I had exactly one day off a week, which was Saturday, but even then I refused to rest. The pastor of the church where I served as volunteer youth pastor was a man 20 years my senior, a man I idolized to such an extent it bordered on unhealthy. I wanted to be this guy. He was, and remains, the best preacher I've ever heard, and was an all-around amazing man. One weekend he approached me and invited me to have breakfast with him the following morning. I was blown away that he would even talk to me, let alone want to spend time one-on-one. I said yes immediately. In the early 1990s, the governor of Louisiana, Buddy Romer, had declared solving the crime problem in New Orleans and Shreveport as one of his primary initiatives. These cities were, at the time, among the top crime centers in the entire country. These were dark, dark places, and Governor Romer was determined to shine some light. He enlisted the aid of local church pastors to head up a volunteer crime-fighting force in the state's most dangerous, most vulnerable communities. And my pastor happened to be one of the pastors involved. When I met him for breakfast at the diner on King's Highway, he said, "Brady, Governor Romer would like our church to participate in fighting crime, and one of the ways I'd like to do that is by starting an Adopt-a-Block program." He grabbed a napkin from the plastic holder, reached for a pen from his shirt pocket, and began to scribble down his thoughts. He dictated as he wrote, "Here's what I think the Lord is asking us to do. Let's take the most violent neighborhoods in our city and break them down into 20 home clusters." We ended up calling them parishes based on Louisiana's long-standing county line structure. He said, "I'm going to go before the church and ask for families to adopt each of these parishes, but I need somebody to head up the whole thing. This is where you come in, Brady. I'd like you to administer the entire program, to organize whatever needs organizing, and see it all through to the end. I need you to go into all these neighborhoods, be my eyes and ears on the ground, sort out the urgency for me, determining which blocks require our attention most. I need you to tell me where our people need to be and how we can position ourselves most strategically to help reduce gang activity and crime in our state. I still have that napkin. That napkin meant the world to me because it was given to me on the day when one of my living heroes invited me into the game. The beloved pastor's vision for city renewal shapes my ministry still to this day. So he extended the offer, and of course I accepted. He needed me, after all. How I needed to be needed. This was an easy yes. Running to save my hide. The first few weeks in my new role as the de facto kill crime, not each other administrator were spent going on ride-alongs with various police officers who were accustomed to the high crime beat. According to their assessment of things, the safest time of the week for me to be in these neighborhoods was from 8 until noon on Saturday mornings, when gang lords were still fast asleep. Saturday, my only day off. Saturday it was. During those car rides, my newfound police force friends would point out various houses and say such things as, "That's where the 12-year-old girl was raped last night. Here's where that murder yesterday took place. A couple of Bloods live there. A few Crips there. That's where the shooting happened. This sweet grandmother here has lost 2 grandkids to guns. She wants to move away, but where's she supposed to go?" I didn't know these people yet, but their stories were tenderizing my heart. I wanted to rescue them, to save them, to deliver them from this sin-stained life. And so, with all the passion and energy I could muster, I began mapping out the most violent neighborhood, street by street by street, noting the most dangerous violators and most vulnerable residents. And then I came up with ideas for serving them both. When I finished mapping that first neighborhood, I began mapping the next. And when that one was completed, I started in on the third. On and on I went, organizing 200 parishes in all. Our church eventually adopted 4,000 homes, and I became the steward over them all. Pam and I raised our hands, along with 199 other families, to adopt a block of these homes. And so every Saturday morning, we'd make our way to Abbey Street, knocking on doors, meeting our families, and as time went on, serving them, praying with them, loving them, and meeting their needs as best we could. I would arrive early those Saturday mornings and teach outreach principles to all 200 church families who'd come to serve, and then we'd disband to visit our adopted families. Then, several hours later, after those morning visits were completed, we'd reconvene and celebrate and tell stories of what God had done. By the time Pam and I got home, it would be 2 in the afternoon. So from 8 in the morning until mid-afternoon, year after year after year, this is how my day off got spent. It was a far cry from what Pam signed up for when she married me. During those first years of marriage, Pam probably envisioned lazy Saturday mornings, late breakfasts, a few hours to enjoy life as husband and wife. Instead, she got busyness, chaos, and a husband too distracted to see straight. Yes, she loved serving those folks on Abbey Street, and yes, she enjoyed being with me, even if we were busy. But she deserved better. She deserved more. She deserved better and more of me. House in Flames. For 4 straight years, I kept this pace, never stopping even to blink. In fact, whenever it seemed I might be able to slow my pace a bit, I let myself get roped into further busyness, which caused further strife at home. On one occasion during those years when I had been coaching all those teams, driving the athletic bus, washing the uniforms, the whole bit, the day came when basketball season was over, meaning I could finally catch a break. The day after the season ended, the school's athletic director called all of the head coaches into his office and explained he had fired the track coach that morning, for good reason, according to him. Baseball season was in full swing, so the baseball coach couldn't help out. Spring football had already begun, so the football coach couldn't help out, which left me. All eyes cut to me. "Brady," the AD said, "I need you to coach track." End of discussion. In a split second, My long-awaited dream of being home at 3:30 or 4 every afternoon vanished into thin air. I informed Pam of my new role, and not long after that, I came home to find that my wife of 5 years had packed her bags. I think her exact explanation was, "If I'm going to be a single woman, I'd rather be single at my parents' house." Admittedly, it wasn't my best day. I was talking with a friend recently about this dark season from my past, and she asked, "Weren't there warning shots fired along the way?" Translation: didn't you know what an idiot you were being? Yeah, I suppose the answer is yes, which proves it actually is possible to be too busy putting out other fires to notice your own house is going up in flames. My lovely and devoted wife would often ask if we could go on a date along the way. But who had time for that? A clear example comes to mind. 2 weeks prior, on a rare Saturday when we didn't have parish ministry, Pam looked forward to spending time as a couple, just the two of us, with nothing on the agenda for an entire day. But that wasn't meant to be. I had been invited by a local soup kitchen to speak to their staff and guests, and because I didn't have any other obligations that day, I jumped at the opportunity to serve. It actually never occurred to me to invite Pam on a date or to plan together time for the day. It also never occurred to me to tell her of my plans at the soup kitchen. That Saturday morning, I got dressed, grabbed a piece of toast, and headed for the door. I quickly pecked Pam on the cheek as I mumbled a bread-crumbed goodbye, which is when I noticed there was no return greeting from my wife. There was nothing but an icy stare. You know that stare, the one that tells you that a time bomb is about to go off. It's not a good look to get. Wordlessly, she conveyed her furor over my making plans without her for the day, and in response, I wordlessly conveyed my furor over her failing to understand how much my ministry mattered to me. When the icy stare did give way to actual words, Pam said, "You're not building God's kingdom. You're building the empire called Brady Boyd." The trouble with seeking my own glory. Of course, my wife was right all along, despite my inability to see the cold, hard truth for what it was. In hindsight, I see that the problem for me back then was I was seeing so much fruit from all my hard work. I was saving the city, right? I was showing up, working hard, being celebrated left and right. "Brady, tell us another story," my pastor would say to me in front of the church's eager Sunday morning congregation. "Come up here and tell us what you saw happen yesterday." And so I would. I'd take the podium and explain how I'd seen a man in an adjacent neighborhood have his blind eyes literally healed right before my own. Or how another guy's withered hand returned to normal while I held it, just like in biblical times. Or how a couple that had cussed us out week after week finally listened to the story of Christ. One woman, oh, this one blew me away. She was a prostitute when my wife and I met her, but she eventually surrendered her life to the Lord. Come on now. Pam wanted me to walk away from all this? I was in my glory, which should have been my first clue that something was amiss. It was my glory I was seeking, and it was my glory that I gained. But nothing seemed broken back then. I kept gulping down that sweet-tasting fruit, the fruit of all those harried weeks, followed by all those not-quite-relaxing days off. Unfortunately, the taste didn't sit so well with Pam, and she thought it best to let me know. To her, I was a dead man walking. She'd already begun preparing my last meal. I walked into our tiny house that night, saw Pam, disillusioned, angry, D-O-N-E, done, and her packed bags, and experienced the lead weight in the bottom of my stomach. You know, the one that tells you all is not right in your world. The Pam I'd married 5 years prior was gentle, calm, a lamb, not a lion, a peacemaker, not prone to provoke. But here, now with those packed bags signaling her seriousness, I saw another woman emerge, a woman who refused to be taken for granted, a woman who would rather be single than be married and do life all alone. I may not have been super smart, but there were signals even a dumb jock shouldn't have missed. "Pam," I said, my voice low and my words slow, "if you will stay here tonight, if you will agree not to leave tonight, I will walk in tomorrow and resign." The red rims around her eyes told me she'd been crying all afternoon. "No, you won't," she challenged. "You won't." I asked for 24 hours to prove that I'd make good on my promise. And by that time the following day, I had resigned every last role. I told the principal that I would finish out the school year, but that at that point I was done. She was floored, as was everyone else who discovered what I'd done. I had taken our girls' team to the state semis, where they played in front of 5,000 people, and had been voted Coach of the Year for our district. Suffice it to say, I was invested in my endeavors. And then one day, I quit. "How can you not want to coach anymore?" people would say, as though I'd decided to stop being human. In my heart, I knew the answer. I did want to keep coaching. I just wanted to keep being married more. A long-awaited turning point. I continued to work hard in the years that followed, but with a loving wife and then eventually two small children at home, I gladly kept my schedule in check. They were my magnetic north, my motivation to stay healthy and whole. And I did, largely. I went to work in radio, making stagnant stations profitable. Then, in a strange turn of events, I was invited to enter a new role, that of pastor, first of a small church in Texas, then to a not-so-small church in Texas called Gateway. Fast forward to 2007. New Life Church in Colorado Springs came calling, wondering if I'd be interested in being the new senior pastor. The founding pastor, Ted Haggard, had resigned his post after a moral failure, and the church was wounded and raw. I didn't think I'd had a shot after that first interview with the search committee, but as weeks passed, I received word that among the candidates, I was in the top 10, and then the top 4, and then, assuming the congregation was amenable to the idea, that I'd be the new guy. In those first months at the helm of New Life, I remember sticking to my rhythmic routine. Senior staffers used to mock me for how much I rested, in fact. Once I pulled aside one of the other pastors and asked, "So what do people say about me behind my back? What's the big Pastor Brady inside joke?" He didn't even hesitate. "It's that if we ever can't find you, you're probably busy taking a nap somewhere." This probably wasn't meant as a compliment, but I took it as one. To me, it meant I'd been released from the desperation that is death row. I'd finally learned to slow down. During those first few years at my new church, I worked hard at rest, and I encouraged everyone who would listen to join me. At the close of Sunday morning services, I'd tell our congregation to go home and take a nap. I forced all our long-term staff members to take six-week sabbaticals and to actually rest while they were gone. To various ministry department leaders, I'd say, "Speed of the leader, speed of the team. The reason your staff is exhausted and cranky is because you are behaving the very same way." To my credit, this lasted a while, for just over 4 years, I think. And this was a necessary thing. Our church had been through a sex scandal, not pertaining to me, I should clarify, and a deadly shooting, followed by months and months of heart-wrenching devastation and grief. It was tough going there for a while, validating my early suspicions when the search committee declared me the new pastor that I was actually coming to Colorado to preside over a long, slow death. New Life had been a marvelous church for nearly 3 decades, but even the sturdiest of congregations can't survive a scandal and a shooting. Those churches become used car lots. So while I kept my optimism close at hand, as I made my way to Colorado, I wondered if I'd actually signed up to serve as a hospice nurse, somebody to provide a little dignity while the one who lays dying fades from this thing called life. The numbers initially proved me right. After 2 murders on our campus, attendance flagged, tithes declined, and morale took an understandable hit. In many ways, we were a healthier bunch than we'd ever been, thanks to the sane pace I insisted we prize. But even a well-rested church ceases to flourish when people and money go away. I was right in the middle of bracing myself for our inevitable demise when the miraculous happened. The deceased came back to life. You know peace when you find it. In the summer of 2011, on the heels of that rhythmic 4-year run, I admitted myself into a Denver hospital, took a deep breath, and waited to be prepped for surgery. According to the cardiovascular experts who advised my mom when I was a young boy, the congenital heart condition I was graced with would require several interventions throughout my life. This one was one of those interventions: valve replacement, a little spring cleaning, perhaps insertion of a defibrillator just for grins. I was terrified, and also strangely at peace. Looking back, I see that the 9 weeks surrounding that surgery were some of the best weeks of my life. The days leading up to and following the wild ride of having my chest cavity split wide open afforded me unprecedented opportunities for rest. And rest I did. I had no choice in the matter, really. I was so weakened by the process that my body insisted I slow down. It has been said, pain comes alive when it talks, even more so when it cries. This is how so many of us find rest, isn't it? We don't find it at all. More the case, it finds us. Wayne Muller wrote, "If we do not allow for a rhythm of rest in our overly busy lives, illness becomes our Sabbath. Our pneumonia, our cancer, our heart attack, our accidents create Sabbath for us." My heart surgery wasn't necessarily medically connected to the stress I chose to bear in my life, but spiritually, I saw it for what it was. Finally, a chance to rest. During the 8 days I was in the hospital, I pretty much lived in my bed. The sole instruction I'd been given by docs was to rest, and then rest some more. I took only a few infrequent and poorly executed strolls up and down the hallway outside my room. My Dallas Mavericks were vying for the NBA championship that year, and luckily for me, there was a little television at my bedside. Late one night, probably as a result of my euphoria over the success of the Mavs, I was still lying there awake at 2 o'clock in the morning. The blinds on my window were raised, and through my fourth floor window I spotted a full moon in all its glory, a great big ball of bright light. I lay there quietly, taking it in, talking to God while staring at that moon. When was the last time I'd done that? Had I ever been so at peace in my life during an insomniac moment such as this? The reality was that I had absolutely nothing to do the next day. Nothing to do but rest. And so I just breathed. I sank deeper into my bed. I talked to God. Most important, I didn't fret. Eventually, I fell asleep. I returned to my leadership responsibilities weeks later, but took things slow for a while. I preached while perched on a stool, for instance. I kept my meeting schedule light. I left the office early every afternoon so I could go home and take a leisurely walk. Interestingly, during those slow-going weeks and months following my surgery, my preaching improved. My leadership improved. My ability to think even improved. My surgeon explained that the leaky valve I'd been living with had been taking a hit on my energy level, and now that we'd replaced it, I'd seen an uptick in stamina and drive. But I suspect there was something more spiritual at work. I think things were turning around for the better because the point person had learned to rest. Or had I? For the 2 full years since my surgery, New Life has had the Midas touch. We've watched everything we've put in our hands turn to kingdom gold. Attendance is soaring, giving is increasing, and involvement is at an all-time high. There is growth. There is energy. There is momentum. There is fun. Simultaneously, my rhythmic living has absolutely gone down the tubes. I've always said the greatest risk to restfulness is success. Now, more than ever, I stand by that claim. Failure invites us to pause, to regroup, to take stock, and to rest. In the sorrow, in the pain, in the deep, dark valleys we tend to find ourselves in, we are humbled. We are pensive, and we are undone. As a result, we tend to stop. But when we're soaring up with the eagles, well, who wants to come down from that? Here's what happened to me. While I was crouched over, offering what I thought was a little merciful mouth-to-mouth to a dying church, the thing had the audacity to sputter, to come to life, to take off and run. How was this even possible? I thought we'd never see success again at New Life Church. I know what success looks like. At Gateway, we went from 150 people to 12,000 in 7 years. That looked like success. That looked like what happens in a church where there have been no scandals, no shootings, no struggles just to stay alive. But new life? Who would have predicted she would rise from the ashes and live? But I liked how success felt. I didn't want to unplug. I didn't want to relax. The last thing I craved was rest. To allow any semblance of space to come between our church's newfound success and me was to cause the undesirable effects of withdrawal. I had become an addict again, an addict in search of a fix, a speed and wild success junkie who never wanted to come down. And so I didn't. I stayed up, up, up for 2 years straight, flying high on the wings of achievement, soaking up the opportunities, the attaboys, the hope. Truly, when things are shiny and wonderful, there is no better role in the world than that of a megachurch pastor. But I ran too hard, too fast, too far, and I neglected the rhythms I said mattered most. I allowed the joyride to carry me away, to cause me to drift toward frantic and frail. This makes sense, doesn't it? Because we never drift toward restoration, and we never drift into a place of peace. Eventually, I melted down. Again, hello, Death Row, it's me, Brady, back for another stay. Sometimes, rest finds us. Around the same time I realized I'd forsaken all the restfulness I'd worked so hard to attain, a pastor friend of mine resigned from his church. He was asked to resign, actually. In a turn of events that seems tragically cliché, he'd engaged in a sexual relationship with a young woman on his staff. For 30-plus years, he had founded and then formed this fantastic, thriving congregation, and in one swift move, he tossed it all away. His life, his marriage, his credibility with his kids, his future, their future, the whole deal, he threw it all away. After the dust settled, I contacted a member of his team, and here is what he said to me privately. He didn't know how to get off the roller coaster. So my friend had decided to make it stop. Of course, he didn't do this consciously. It's not as though he woke up one morning and said, "Gee, today I think I'll wreck my entire life." No, something in his psyche just knew the ride had to stop. And because my friend didn't know how to seek out healthy rhythms on his own, he made decisions that would utterly force him to rest. This is how so many of us find rest, remember? Sometimes it just finds us. It occurs to me that this could be why roller coaster rides never last for more than about 2 minutes. We simply can't take the adrenaline surge for much longer than that. I think this is true in life outside the amusement park as well. We've got to learn how to stop the ride without sabotaging our very lives. It has been 7 months since my friend left ministry, and while he hates what happened, the choices he made, the lives he wrecked, the stained reputation that will forever be attached to his name, he admits that he has never been as healthy in his adult life as he is today. It took a scandal that rocked his world and the loss of everything he held dear in order to finally learn how to slow down, to tend his soul, and to rest. It's a story that shakes me to my core. I don't want to be that guy. I want to learn the easy way, not the hard way, from here on out anyway. I want to live as a person of rest. I want to be drawn in by the restfulness of Christ, by the rhythms He has asked me to prize. Breaking busy. To begin breaking your addiction to busy, take a few minutes to engage with the breaking busy challenges at each chapter's end. Give yourself grace as you go. Changing long-standing patterns isn't easy, but boy, is it worth it in the end. Your family, your friends, your colleagues, and even your own soul will thank you for investing time and energy in charting a new and healthier course for your life. Challenge number one. Acknowledge unhealthy rhythms. Even the healthiest and holiest people have some rhythms that don't serve them well. Maybe you too need to chronically sign up for more than what your soul's capacity will allow, and perhaps you also need to be needed. Maybe you consistently neglect to carve out time to spend with God each day, or you come down from a work week in a less than stellar way. Think about your own life, your own daily ebbs and flows. What rhythms aren't serving you well? Which could stand to be adjusted or altogether removed? On a sheet of paper or in your journal, jot down the unhealthy rhythms that come to mind. Don't worry yet with how to change them. We'll deal with that in a later chapter. For now, simply get them down in writing so that they're top of mind as you listen on. Challenge number 2. Accurately count the cost. Next, beside each rhythm you've noted, record the toll each one is taking on your life. For example, if you don't spend time daily reading the scriptures or praying, you may feel your days lack purpose, or that a pervasive spirit of anxiety hovers over you like a cloud. Or if you tend to relax after a long work week by drinking too much or neglecting quality time with your family, you may feel disconnected from those you love most. If you struggle to count the cost for each unhealthy rhythm you've jotted down, try asking the question, what would be working better in my life if I could shift this rhythm from unhealthy to healthy? The answer to that question just might reveal to you what it is you presently lack. Chapter 2. Restless Bodies, Restless Minds. I love a broad margin to my life. Henry David Thoreau. I do too, Henry. But who has time for that? Brady. Suffering from the and-then syndrome. I'm sitting in my office at the church as I work on this chapter. It's a good-sized office with thick walls, carpeted flooring, and a wooden door that shuts. In other words, it should be a place of peace and quiet. It was designed for peace and quiet, which is a good thing because this is where I study for sermons, where I hold important meetings, and where I write. But too often, while I'm sitting in here, in this supposed place of peace and quiet, this is the thought that races through my mind. I wish I had some peace and quiet. Interesting, isn't it? I can't find peace of mind in a place solely dedicated to my peace of mind. There's a reason for this. Most days I step inside my office ready to get some work done. I shut the door behind me, figuratively closing off the rest of the world. I get comfortable at my desk, fire up my laptop, and ready my mind and my fingers for the task at hand. Peace. Quiet. Yes, now I can make some strides. And then I think, I'd like to listen to some music. And so I launch my Pandora app. And then I remember a friend telling me about a terrific TED talk he heard. And I search for the file online. And then I think of the recent tornadoes in Oklahoma. And I decide to run a local news feed in the background. And then I wonder about my friend's Facebook updates and decide to scroll through them just for a sec. And then I check to see if anyone has retweeted the clever tweet I tweeted last night. And then while I'm on the web, I Google my name, which is never a wise thing to do. The time-wasting tangent I then pursue lasts 20 minutes at least. And then, look, my buddy in Texas sends me a YouTube link, explaining that this is the funniest thing since the video on the evolution of dance. And sucker that I am, I click on it, I watch it, and I'm actually dumber in 3 minutes flat. And then I hear the people outside my office chatting and laughing and carrying on, and I wonder what they're doing, so I just pop my head out there and see. A really smart psychologist wrote a book about people like me, people who suffer from and-then syndrome. He refers to us as the frazzled. It sounds cute and cuddly, doesn't it? Sort of like a harmless, furry Muppet. It's not cute and cuddly. It's deadly to both body and mind. Frazzle is when you can't hold a thought in your mind for 2 seconds before it disappears into thin air. Frazzle is when you can't concentrate on A because you start thinking about B and C. Frazzle is when there's a washing machine in your head and it's permanently set on spin cycle. Frazzle is when you can't find peace and quiet in the quietest, most peaceful place. Sadly, for people like me anyway, those who insist on staying frazzled, we ultimately fizzle out. In his groundbreaking book, Adrenaline and Stress, Dr. Archibald Hart supports this idea with results from the research he's done. People in a hurry don't allow time for their complex bodies and minds to become revitalized, he wrote. So they accelerate the wear and tear of their bodies. There is no time for contemplation or even meditation. Anxiety increases, and they lose perspective on their problems because they don't have time to think constructively. This makes them even more stressed and less able to cope with the strains of life, thus exacerbating the stress of life. In short, he goes on, people of our time are showing signs of physiological and psychological disintegration because they are living at warp speed. Disintegration isn't a good way to articulate my aspirations in life. Is it a good way to articulate yours? Especially for those of us who say we love God, falling apart and fizzling out aren't exactly the goal. I should mention here that I'm referring to those of us who are choosing frazzle as our M.O. Clearly, so many men and women are not, such as those who have been handed exhausting situations. I think of friends of mine who have a special needs child, or friends who have decided to take in an elderly parent, or friends who have chronic health issues of their own. I think of those whose spouses are on tours of duty, and those who work 3 part-time jobs every day just to make ends meet, and those who have 6 kids, all less than 6 years old, whom they need to care for and love well and feed. Whenever people who are involuntarily frazzled seek out my advice, I work with them on reducing chaos, while recognizing that in many cases, a certain amount of chaos is going to be part of the equation for a while. But back to my loving diatribe aimed at people like me, people who tend to willingly sign up for craziness, who tend to intentionally live chaotic lives. We are not doing as well as we think. What the weary will do. I'm a man who loves God. I love worshiping God, following God, and hearing from God through prayer. But what occurs to me is that it's more than a little difficult to pay attention to God's thoughts when I can't even pay attention to my own. Throughout the normal course of my days, if someone were to ask, Brady, what are you thinking about? I'd actually have to pull back for a minute and think about what I was thinking about, which tells me I wasn't being very intentional with those original thoughts. This would be fine, except that the Bible says it's not fine. Instead, the Bible tells me to take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ, and to love the Lord my God with all my mind, and to have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, and to think about things that are true and noble and pure, and to set my mind on things above, not on earthly things, and to actually count God's thoughts as precious, something I'm rarely able to do. To count God's thoughts as precious assumes I am first even aware of His thoughts. I'm pretty sure someone as perpetually distracted as I am isn't scoring any victories on this front. I keep thinking about this idea, how too often I'm not in touch with what I'm thinking. The last few days I've been testing myself, pausing periodically throughout the day and asking, Brady, quick, what are you thinking about? Which has led me to an early conclusion. What I spend the vast majority of my time thinking about is not what I'm supposed to be thinking about. I crave rest for my body, yes, but more immediately, and for reasons that are now obvious, I crave it for my mind. I want to know what God is thinking. I want to know what He is thinking about my spiritual development. I want to know His thoughts on my wife and on my kids, on my colleagues, on my friends, on my neighbors, on our world at large. How can I possibly serve His restoration agenda in this world when I can't get a bead on His thoughts? I do want to know His thoughts, but that will require margin, space, and time. Margin, space, and time are things I desperately want these days. I know I'm not alone. Ultimately, every problem I see and every person I know is a problem of moving too fast for too long in too many aspects of life. Every problem. And I see a lot of problems. Sex and money problems in marriage come back to the issue of speed. How eager for intimacy are you when you're exhausted at the end of yet another grueling workday? Negligence in business practices comes back to the issue of speed. friendships that aren't quite clicking can usually point to the culprit of speed. Speed is the single greatest threat to a healthy life, and it is also our greatest defense. We think if we can keep going, keep moving, and keep plowing ahead, our consciences won't have time to catch us because, we'll already be long gone. And the reality is, this approach actually works, but only for a time. In his book Sabbath, author Wayne Muller wrote, "I had put a quote from Brother David Steindl Rast on my bulletin board. Life, he said, was like the breath. We must be able to live in an easy rhythm between give and take. If we cannot learn to live and breathe in this rhythm, we will place ourselves in grave danger, maybe even the literal grave." Learning from the unrested best. 3 weeks ago, I received word that one of my closest friends had been hospitalized during an international trip. He had flown halfway around the world to speak at a high-profile pastors' conference, but toward the end of his trip, his stress level took him down. He was in his hotel room the night before he was due to speak when a throbbing migraine struck. Everything seemed to make it worse. Movement, light, sound. And so he lay there in the quiet darkness, willing it to go away. But it didn't. It only got worse. He called the cell number he had for the host pastor and asked if there was a doctor in the man's congregation who might be willing to stop by. The pain was making him dizzy and nauseated, and my friend's anxiety level was rising by the hour. What could possibly be wrong with him? What could bring on sharp pain like this? An hour later, a doctor from the church made his way to my friend's hotel room. The doc did an examination and prescribed some meds, and then before leaving gave him specific instructions on the drugs and a shot in the arm of something intense. But evidently, the painkiller he just administered didn't sit too well with my friend. Within minutes, my buddy's stomach began bleeding, and in a few hours, he'd lost 4 pints of blood. The average adult has approximately just 10 pints to start with. The situation was turning serious and fast. After an ambulance ride, 3 days in a foreign hospital, and a touch-and-go trip back home, my friend survived. But not without being changed by the experience. His regular doctor here in the States ordered a stress reduction immediately. Evidently, my buddy's adrenal system was so used and abused, what, for going on 30 years, that his body had begun to shut down. The only thing that would make him healthy again was rest. A whole lot of concentrated rest. I talked to my friend after he'd returned home, and over the phone I could nearly hear him shaking his head at himself. "I've been running too fast," he said. "Too fast for way too long." Involuntarily, my cheeks burned in recognition. I had spent nearly 2 decades running too fast for too long. Would that damage catch up to me someday too? A handful of elders from the church where he pastors banded together and formed something of an arbitration committee that would help him streamline his schedule for the foreseeable future. Begging off of current obligations and declining speaking opportunities that had not been accepted yet. But in one sense, this intervention was too little too late. Frightening damage had already been done. We love and admire and follow these leaders because of the great gains we believe them to make, and yet we unwittingly cheer them right over the cliff, wishing them well as they crash to the ground. Even now, as I'm typing this paragraph, a tweet appears on my feed from a pastor I really should quit following. It reads, and I quote, "Taped a TV show, wrote a new talk, ran 5 miles, all on my day off. What did you do on your day off?" No rest for the weary, right? We're learning from the unrested best. We owe one another better than this. We owe one another rest. But what does real restfulness look like for ones so addicted to hardcore, fast-paced lives? Where do we even begin? Breaking busy. Challenge number 1. Fess up. Look back at the list of unhealthy rhythms you made at the close of the last chapter, and also at what each of those rhythms is costing you in terms of quantity and quality of life. Now take things one step further by logging a few things that weariness has caused you to do along the way. Have you cut corners in business practices? Shortchanged your children the devoted attention from you they deserve? Allow key relationships to slip into maintenance mode? Something else? Ask God to show you what weariness has instigated in your life, and record the revelations you receive. Challenge number 2. You in 10 words. Now to a cheerier exercise. On a fresh sheet of paper, number a list 1 to 10. Beside each number, write down an adjective you wish to be true of you. Maybe you are sick of running yourself ragged and long to be peaceful. Or maybe you are fed up with shortchanging your kids and want to be engaged or present. Perhaps you see clearly how far you've run from God and want to re-up your commitment to being righteous. Whatever the dream looks like, try to describe it in 10 adjectives. Chapter 3. Distraction versus Devotion. He who can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapped in awe is as good as dead. His eyes are closed. Albert Einstein. Perilous Progress. Matthew Sleeth wrote, "We are a hydroponic society, fed by the drip irrigation of electronic social networks." And I happen to think he's right. He's right, and he's right for good reason. Technology is fascinating, and smartphones are amazing. It was only a few decades ago that the only telephone I had access to was a rotary dial clunker in my parents' living room. I'm sure many of you remember those. If your number had a bunch of nines in it, nobody ever called you because it was just too much work pulling the little wheel all the way around again and again. My aunt and uncle lived across the street, and my family shared a party line with them. If the phone rang once, it was for us. If it rang twice, it was for them. But to my point, look at the progress we've made. On my smartphone today, I have instant access to pretty much everyone I've ever known or could ever want to know via Facebook, Twitter, at Pastor Brady, not that I'd ever self-promote, and a phone that can call anywhere in the world. I have weather updates, including live Doppler images for any city on planet Earth. I have a camera and 1,000 of my recent photos right here, ready to show you. Instagram, at Pastor Brady.